Indonesia and Hawaii, Occidental and Colombia, the far south side of Chicago and the villages of rural Kenya, the law schools of Harvard and the University of Chicago, the Illinois State Legislature and the practice of civil rights law. Why should we choose among these options as we try to make sense of Barack Obama's development? As his books make clear, his experiences wrestling with all these diverse cultures and institutions shaped his sensibility. His multiple commitments to grassroots organizing, church-based social networks of Christian activists, law conceived as an instrument of democratic deliberation and community building, William James's and John Dewey's pragmatist philosophy, economic populism, and the resolution shared by Ralph Ellison, Martin Luther King Jr., and Malcolm X to affirm the principle in the face of racism. All of these may seem incompatible to some people today. Yet I see no reason why they should prove any more inconsistent now than they were decades ago, when numerous and influential progressive reformers shared just such experiences, ideas, and aspirations, and effected important, if incomplete, change.
That's a passage from Reading Obama, Dreams, Hope, and the American Political Tradition, a book by James Kloppenburg, our guest today. I'm Emily Auerbach.
I'm Norman Gilliland. This is University of the Air.
Why is it that President Barack Obama puzzles observers, labeled as dangerous by the right and spineless by the left? What makes Obama avoid absolutes, choosing instead to seek consensus after democratic deliberation? How is the president's political philosophy and approach to his office shaped by his upbringing, his study of American history, and his reading of literature and philosophy? Joining us to update his 2011 study from Princeton University Press called Reading Obama is James Kloppenburg, the Charles Warren Professor of American History at Harvard University.
Welcome to University of the Air.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you.
Well, this is a difficult topic in some ways because it has so much to do with how much deliberation is good and at what point do you actually have to make a decision, be decisive, and in fact be nationalistic in a nationalistic world. So where does Obama fall on the scale of being between being indecisive and being a person who looks at things from all angles?
Well, I think his strategy of looking at things from all angles and engaging in deliberation worked brilliantly for him through his entire career until he became president of the United States. And at that point, his attempt to engage those who disagreed with him in a constructive dialogue began to fail immediately. Probably many of your listeners will have heard the session he conducted with Republican leaders in Congress on the question of health care early in his presidency. And I happened to spend the afternoon watching that because I thought it was a masterful performance of someone trying to instruct people who were both ill-informed and who tended to disagree with everything he believed about how they should reconsider their assumptions and inform themselves about the situation they were dealing with. And yet it had no effect whatsoever. Again and again, you could hear people simply restating exactly what right. They had said after he had made a good faith effort, I think, to engage them where they were. Well, and I think from a very early moment in his presidency, it began to be apparent that American politics has changed in a really dramatic way.
That's what I was going to ask, because, I mean, we think of like LBJ as saying, come, let us reason together, and being so compatible even with opposing people in Congress and working things out constantly, working things out, compromising. But this doesn't play so well for Obama today.
Yeah, I think what people tend to forget is that both Franklin Roosevelt and Lyndon Johnson had overwhelming Democratic majorities
helps,
in the Congress when they were trying to get their ambitious social programs passed. And in addition, party politics was something very different in the 1930s and 1960s. If you were a member of the Democratic Party, it was understood that you had a certain loyalty to your president. And it was also understood that there were certain kinds of carrots as well as sticks that party leaders could use. Those simply don't work anymore. There was a wonderful book published by Michael Grunewald called The New New Deal about the stimulus package that was passed early in Obama's presidency. And in that book, he details the kinds of deals that Obama tried to make and the few he succeeded in making, and shows just how different those were from what went on 30 and 60 years earlier.
Why don't they work? Why doesn't the pork barrel have pork in it?
Well, that's a good question. When they were successful in getting the $800 billion stimulus package, many members of the administration realized that wouldn't be enough, but they assumed that when they went back to Congress and offered another bridge or another highway to get more money into the economy, people would say, well, yes, Mr. President, we'd be happy to have that. But instead, for the first time in anybody's memory, Republican lawmakers simply said, no, we're not interested.
Why do you think that is?
There's a strong ideological commitment to opposing everything mm-hmm. that government does from that Ronald Reagan mantra, government is the problem, not the solution. And that is something that neither Franklin Roosevelt nor Lyndon Johnson had to face.
Right.
What about George W. Bush when the shoe was on the other foot and the Republicans are proposing things? Did the Democratic Congress resist every Republican proposal?
Well, anything that involved government spending, anything that involved a social program that the Democrats liked, they were more willing to consider. That, I think, is one of the things that's so striking, that when you simply say no to government, as this Republican Party tends to do, and you know this from what's happened to the Republican Party in Wisconsin, it's very hard to govern. And so I think this is something new in American Democratic history.
I wanted to talk to you about your title, Reading Obama, because I like the way you can take it in a couple of different directions, where part of it is, you know, how do we read him? How do we interpret him? But it's also Obama as a reading person, you know, the books he read. I'm just curious what led you to embark on this particular project, Writing, Reading Obama, and what sort of material, what kind of data you gathered that led to the writing of the book.
Okay. I was teaching at the University of Cambridge in England, and I was struck by how fascinated Brits and Europeans more generally, because I was lecturing on the continent as well, were in Obama. How could a nation with a past as racist as America's past elect an African-American president? People simply couldn't make sense of this. And I was invited to a symposium back in the United States at my alma mater, Dartmouth College. So I reread his memoir, Dreams for My Father, and then read on the way back The Audacity of Hope, his second book. And while I was at Cambridge, I was giving a series of lectures, a series of eight lectures on American political thought. And I found in The Audacity of Hope all of the themes that I had been trying to develop in those lectures. And I was struck by how truly engaging and incisive Obama's analysis is in that book. And so I began trying to figure out, who is this man? Who is this member of the United States Senate who's capable of writing so sophisticated a history of American politics? And so when you put that memoir together, the memoir Dreams for My Father, together with that analysis of American history and politics, you have a really extraordinary writer. And so I began trying to figure out, as an intellectual historian would do, that's my field, the history of ideas, how did this person get to be the man who was able to write those two books? And so I looked at his education. I talked to people who had known him at all different stages of his life. And a very coherent pattern of who he was began to emerge as a very thoughtful, very reflective, very deliberative person. Mm-hmm. And so as I continued to probe that and talk to the people who had known him and continued reading and everything he had written and the speeches that he had given, I decided there's a little book here that mm-hmm. that won't explain everything about him, but it explains something that I think most of the biographies don't explain, and that is how he thinks.
Mm-hmm. Getting back to this theme of deliberation and the need for immediate action, do you see instances in which Obama has been able to act quickly and decisively?
Well, I think the classic example is the capture and killing of bin Laden. That photograph of him in the decision room is one that is seared in the minds of every American. And I think, for better or worse, that really did change the conversation. It made it much harder for people to say he's simply indecisive, that he can't make up his own mind. Some of the people I had talked to who worked in his Senate office said that it bothered them that it was so difficult to get him to come to a decision, that he always wanted to be sure he had all points of view. And that, I think, is very deep in him. And I think in many ways, it's an admirable quality.
But it's
not
a luxury
to be so sure.
You can't always afford.
Well, one could ask whether we would be better as a nation if our presidents had shown more willingness to second-guess themselves and less willingness to act on their first impulse.
Well, yeah, mm-hmm. There's certainly many instances in which we could say, yes, better that they had thought about this more.
Right.
But it's always a difficult call.
It's a very difficult call. And when you're the executive, it's different from being a legislator.
Right.
And this is the first time he's been in that situation. Most presidents make missteps at some point along the way during their presidency. And I'm sure there are moments that he will come to regret. I think the idea that we were drawing a line in the sand in Syria was one of those that he's going to regret. But if you think about it, that's a very rare moment in his presidency. This is a man who doesn't do lines in the sand.
So he was actually sort of sticking himself out. He was out of character.
I think
he
was being somebody else. And I think that's the biggest problem in finding yourself faced with dealing with issues of foreign policy in particular, for which little in his background had really prepared.
Which does require you sometimes to act quickly because the other people are not necessarily going to be acting rationally or reasonably.
It's true, and it's very difficult, and it's very hard to know in those situations how any individual, no matter how thoughtful or well-informed, would choose.
Well, let's look at that background, sort of what made him come to this identity that he has. Can you look at his multiracial background, the many places that his family called home, and sort of where do you see the formation of a kind of global consciousness that he has?
Right. Many people have zeroed in on the fact that he is the product of a Kenyan father and an American woman from the Great Plains, from Kansas, and that he was raised in Indonesia and Hawaii, not exactly the heartland of America. But one of the striking things to me is when he was running for Illinois State Senate and some of the people in his campaign team said to him, "Now, Barack, we're going down south, and this is going to be very strange for you. These are not your urban folks here in Chicago." And when he came back, he said, "Those are my grandparents. I know those people." So I think it is interesting the way in which he has been able to have the distance that you would have from a cosmopolitan upbringing and having spent time in Indonesia and the multiracial community of Hawaii, but also have a sense of rootedness because of having been raised in large part by those grandparents who are the products of the American Midwest.
How much difference do you think it makes that he doesn't have? He's half African, but he doesn't have the slave tradition that African Americans have, other African Americans.
This is one of the dimensions of his sensibility that has prompted a lot of really thoughtful writing. And many people who have studied the African American experience have placed it in dialogue with the experience of immigrants to the United States from Africa and from the Caribbean who don't have that African-American experience. And it is quite a different experience for those people. Obama is a student of the African-American tradition and I think understands quite well what African-Americans have experienced, but it has not been his experience. That's a good point.
What did he get from reading, you know, Frederick Douglass? You talk also about Ralph Ellison, Langston Hughes, W.E.B. Du Bois. Can you tell us something of what President Obama would have gotten from the African-American writers that he read and studied?
One of the things that fascinated me when I read Dreams from My Father, which he admits is a constructed memoir. There are lots of conversations in it which he says, "I'm making up dialogue. I couldn't possibly tell you what was actually said when I was 12 years old." But when he was in high school, and this has been corroborated by a number of people who knew him then, he was on his own working his way through the canon of African-American literature. And there are plenty of moments in Dreams from My Father when you can see the clear evidence of Ralph Ellison's classic Invisible Man or W.E.B. Du Bois's notion of the color line or Douglass's conception of what the similarities and differences are between learning how to read and learning how to fight. And one of the most interesting passages in The Audacity of Hope, I think, has to do with Obama's understanding that it's necessary for African Americans to embrace both the conciliation of Martin Luther King Jr. and the iron will of Malcolm X, and not to see those as alternative paths, but instead to see them as strategic choices. And he recognizes in that book something that many people who invoke Malcolm X don't, and that is that after Malcolm's trip to Mecca, he became much more ecumenical in his understandings of how you had to forge alliances. And that's the Malcolm that Obama embraces.
What about the tradition of jazz and blues, which is so much a part of Ellison and Hughes?
Right. Well, I think that's all about improvisation. And I think that's, again, part of Obama's sensibility, that you can't come into any situation with a playbook that tells you exactly what you have to do. You come with a well-informed, highly trained sensibility and judgments, but you can't pretend that they're simply a rule book that will yield the answers in every case. You have to be willing to experiment. You have to be willing to consider all the options. And again, a legislator is expected to do that, an executive has a more difficult time.
With this broad global background of Obama's, you mentioned Hawaii, you mentioned Indonesia, for his formative years, at what point do you think was he considering himself to be an American?
Oh, I think from day one, because clearly his mother is the most important influence on him, and she is in some ways a flag-waving patriot, even though she's a countercultural type. She sees America as a crossroads of cultures, and even though, like many members of the 60s generation, she's critical of many things about America, but she sees America as a place where possibilities are endless.
And what makes him want then to get involved in American politics and changing things? What does he want to change?
Well, this is a fascinating moment in his life. Everyone who knew him as a college student and as a immediate college graduate realized, as he said to many people, that he wanted to be a writer. That was his aspiration. And after a few months in unsatisfying jobs in New York City after graduating from Columbia, he decided to try out the world of community organizing. And he found himself working in a Catholic social service organization on the south side of Chicago. And he has said a number of times since then that that changed his life, that that experience of being around, being engaged with, being immersed in a world of people who were devoting themselves to other people, convinced him that that was what he wanted to do with his life. He wanted to enter the public sector. He wanted to see if he could address problems of poverty, problems of inequality, problems of closed-off opportunities that he had been able to take advantage of, but that many people, particularly people of color, found unavailable to them.
And what kept him from being angry? Because so much of the writing that he's looking at, including Ralph Ellison and a lot of Langston Hughes poetry and many other, Malcolm X and so on, is filled with burning indignation about injustice. And so how does he take sort of this consciousness of the deep evil, the deep injustice, and somehow come up what everybody says is so cool on the surface?
Right.
Where does that come from?
He writes about that, I think, with great insight in Dreams from My Father. He talks about how in high school in Hawaii, he, like every person deemed black, was expected to engage in the kind of talk about honkies and about the evils of the white man. And he said whenever that sort of thing was going on, he couldn't help thinking, those are my grandparents. That's my mother. I just can't generate that degree of hate, nor could he generate the degree of anger that would be understandable in a person who has not been given opportunities. He understood from the beginning that he was exceptionally fortunate to be able to attend a very good school in Hawaii, to be able to attend a college in California first, and then in New York City, and then to be able to go to a very fine law school. So his own life has been, I think, testimony to the possibility for opportunities to be made available to people. And I think that was the reason why he turned against Jeremiah Wright, his longtime friend, the man who converted him to Christianity, the man who married him, baptized their children. Because when Jeremiah Wright said there has simply never been any progress in race relations, whites have never been able to accept blacks, Obama had to say, that's not true. My life is testimony against that claim. And so despite all the reasons why people could legitimately be very angry, he's been able to balance that understanding against his understanding that he himself has been very fortunate.
Did he have difficulty then being half black and half white? I mean, in terms of being accepted by blacks?
Well, I think it may be that adopting the cool attitude or cool style that Emily mentioned is part of that. He, by all accounts, does love to play basketball and is pretty good at it. And so he has, in a variety of ways, been able to make himself a part of black American culture, but he's always remained slightly distant because of his awareness that he was raised by white grandparents and a white mother. So it's both a disadvantage in a certain way and also an advantage, because I think he does have, in the way that biracial people often are, one foot in one culture, another foot in another culture. And the passages in Dreams from My Father that deal with his trip back to Kenya are really very moving, because it's a culture that is as alien to him as any culture in the world, even though the people he meets are his relatives, even though he wants very much to understand that culture and he comes to understand it and to respect it very much. but it is very different from the world in which he grew up. So I think he does see himself as an American, but as an American of the sort that is becoming increasingly common, an American
Certainly.
Who is part of multiple traditions.
So he's come along, obviously, at a time when there's much more acceptance of multiculturalism.
Right. Right, absolutely.
And at what point does he become Barack as opposed to Barry? Or are those two always coexisting?
Well, I think there are different people who call him one or the other. But I think it is, by his own account, when he gives his first political performance when he's in college at Occidental, and he is asked to speak at a rally against apartheid in South Africa. And at that point, I think he embraces the possibility that he has much more in common with the Africans he's talking about in South Africa than he had acknowledged up to that point, and begins thinking of himself more as Barack than as Barry. And there is one particularly fiery African-American woman at Occidental who I think insists on calling him Barack. And I think over time, he internalizes that identity. But for a long period of time in his late teens and early 20s, I think he's going back and forth between the two.
So is he a philosopher president? More on Reading Obama when we continue in a moment with University of the Air. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Norman Gilliland. Our guest is James Kloppenburg, and we are talking about his book, Reading Obama, Dreams, Hope, and the American Political Tradition. I saw an interview with Martin Luther King where he was asked if you could take only one book on an island other than the Bible, what would you take? And he said Plato's Republic. If President Obama were asked the same question, what kind of books do you think he might take based on your study of sort of his reading, his thinking? Do you have any sense of what?
That's a very good question. It really does feel presumptuous even to offer an answer, but I can mention some of the books that he has mentioned over the years, and those would include some that we've mentioned already, W.E.B. Du Bois's Souls of Black Folk, the autobiography of Frederick Douglass, Ralph Ellison's Invisible Man, but probably also the speeches of Abraham Lincoln. Mm-hmm. Whenever he runs through the people in American history who have made a particular impact on him, he often comes back to the phrase, I'm left then with Lincoln. Mm-hmm. It's hard to read Lincoln's speeches without getting a sense of both the tragedies of American history and the possibilities of American history. I think both of those are part of Obama's understanding. But he is a man with multiple interests. He's invoked during his presidency a number of times Reinhold Niebuhr, the Protestant theologian who tries to take the social gospel of early 20th century Christianity and inject a measure of realism into that tradition. And I think that's something that Obama himself takes very seriously as well. So I don't know. I mean, when one reads the books or reads lists of the books that he's buying when he's on vacation with his family, they include a fair number of popular fiction stories too. So I don't want to overstate the high-mindedness of his reading. I think he is a very eclectic reader and part of what makes him an interesting person.
Well, let's talk about Lincoln a little bit. What do you think Obama gets from Lincoln that helps shape how he sees this working with your rivals, trying to bring opposing factions together?
I think it's interesting to realize that what he wrote about Lincoln in The Audacity of Hope was written before he ever had to confront these kinds of challenges himself. But what he took from Lincoln at that point, when he was reflecting on American politics in The Audacity of Hope, was the awareness that there are situations in which compromise is simply impossible, in which you confront a disagreement so fundamental and so profound that there's no alternative to conflict.
Like slavery.
And there was no other way to end slavery in America besides war.
Although it was not realized when Lincoln was inaugurated.
Right, and there's a real question of whether if anyone had known that would be the consequence of war, whether the Union would have chosen to go to war, because anti-slavery was still a minority view in the Union going into the Civil War. But as the war developed, it became the center of the Union struggle, and the war ended with the end of slavery. So I think it is both the awareness of tragic conflicts and the awareness of the ironic outcomes of history that Obama takes from Lincoln, that things do not always turn out in the way you would expect them to turn out, but the best you can do is to try to keep your eye on the goal that you're aiming toward, which initially was the preservation of the Union and became the abolition of slavery, and do what you think can be done to move in that direction. It means tacking back and forth. It means improvising. It means making hard choices. But the question that comes up for anyone who reads Lincoln's second inaugural, probably the greatest speech in American history, with great care, is the understanding that Lincoln had a very different conception of what Reconstruction could be than anyone, practically anyone on either the radical Republican side or elsewhere in American politics had after his death. And the notion that it was possible for there to be a kind of reconciliation that did not involve simply the sacrifice of African Americans, which is what happens when Reconstruction ends, that was Lincoln's goal. And whether he would have been able to make it happen any better than any of the other people who failed miserably at making it happen, we'll never know. But that was the aspiration, and I think that's what Obama is drawn to.
The next president that Obama would be drawn to, FDR or somebody in between?
A number of people attract him, including Woodrow Wilson, because of his ideal of internationalism and because of his commitment to the idea that the government can be used as a positive force in regulating the economy, which was the central idea of the progressive generation.
Another intellectual president.
Exactly.
If I may so, only
exactly.
One with a doctorate.
Right. And the man who was responsible for bringing the progressive income tax into American culture for the first time, and someone who saw it as a way of addressing the problem of inequality, which has become so much more serious in the last 20 years. But what's striking to me about Obama's treatment of FDR in The Audacity of Hope is that he zeroes in on the moment in FDR's presidency when he lays out the most ambitious plan for the post-war world that he ever sketched out, and that's the plan for what he calls the Second Bill of Rights in the 1944 State of the Union address. In that address, Roosevelt called for universal health care, universal government housing provision, a jobs program, a living wage, basically the entire social democratic program that is enacted in Northern Europe after World War II, but that cannot be enacted in the United States because the South resists the idea that these universal programs could be extended to African Americans. In a recent book on the New Deal, Ira Katznelson makes clear that at every step from FDR's election until his death, he was blocked by Southern Democrats who wanted to do everything they could to make sure that white supremacy was not challenged by the programs of the New Deal. And this program that comes out of the Second Bill of Rights is the most ambitious of those programs and would have done the most to challenge the rule of Jim Crow. So that's the FDR that Obama is drawn to, not the haphazard back and forth puzzling figure of the early years of the Roosevelt presidency, but the much more self-confident social democrat of the final years of his presidency.
Is his idea then to pick up where FDR was not able to with universal health care, et cetera?
Precisely. In fact, in The Audacity of Hope, he says this remains the unredeemed promise of the Democratic Party from 1944 until the present. And if you look at the tradition of upper Midwest progressivism, embodied in people like Hubert Humphrey and Walter Mondale. It's a tradition that continues on in one part of the Democratic Party, I'd say the Democratic side of the Democratic Party, but it's a tradition that again and again is blocked in American politics. And one could make the argument, I would be so bold as to make the argument, that race is the reason why that continues
what
to be
about
blocked.
With something like, say, Social Security, what about the practicalities and the demographics and the fact that Social Security was designed for a 1933 population, and we're now 80 years later in a different demographic situation with such a much larger population and a larger bottom to that financially.
Right. It's an expensive proposition to care for old people, but it's also important to remember that when Social Security was enacted, farm workers and domestics were left out. And the reason they were left out is that they were overwhelmingly black. And it was generations before the program became the universal program that it is now. And some people think the same thing will happen with healthcare, that it starts slowly, it has a very rocky beginning, but that in time it can become something more universal. It is simply the case that these kinds of social programs that FDR proposed in 44 and that Northern European nations have been experiencing now for well over half a century, cost a lot of money. And America has the lowest tax rate of any industrialized nation in the world. And so one question we have to ask ourselves as a people, I think, is whether we are willing, as Oliver Wendell Holmes Jr. put it, to pay the price of civilization, which is taxes. And if we're not willing to do that, we are going to find ourselves becoming an undeveloped country. We're going to be surpassed by nations that take the civic sphere and the responsibilities of their citizens seriously and find ourselves in the nations that we used to malign as banana republics or as third world nations, because part of what we're doing is backing ourselves into a world in which the wealthy live lives better than anyone in human history has ever lived, and the other 90% find themselves struggling in ways that their parents and grandparents would find impossible to imagine. Well, there's been no increase in the median income in real dollars in the United States since the 1970s. That's the first time in American history that's been true. And yet there has been massive economic growth, and there has been enormous increases in the wealth of the wealthiest Americans. That's a situation that has no precedent in American history, and I think it's one that has to be addressed.
What about education in terms of Obama's stance on spending, because you mentioned this idea of becoming, you know, a backwater, and we're already seeing that in terms of competing in the world market with science and technological innovation, that we're losing ground to other countries. What's Obama's stand on that, and where the money is going to come from, and who's the opposition?
I'm not sure that the problem is a problem at the level of international competitiveness. If you look at any top university in the United States, from the University of Wisconsin to my own institution, Harvard, a very large number of our advanced graduate students come from elsewhere. They come from from all over the world. We still have, I think, the finest higher education system in the world, and we're still training the people who are doing the cutting-edge science and the cutting-edge engineering, and I think that's what we want to see continuing. I think Obama is much more concerned with what's going on in elementary schools and secondary schools. And nothing that's been tried over the last century seems to have worked very well to address that problem. And it's not at all clear to me exactly what needs to be done. One could make the argument that it's simply a question of resources, but again, what's striking in The Audacity of Hope is that he sees it as a problem not only of resources, but also of cultural orientation.
Commitment.
And believes that it's not only a problem of people who are in government, but a problem that parents have to face, that they have to be more engaged in their children's education. And they can't simply leave it to somebody else. They have to dig in. And all the studies that indicate that parents who are engaged in their children's education do better, their families do better, are proof, I think, that he's onto something there. But this is one of the features of his sensibility that has caused him to be as disappointing to the left as he is frustrating to the right, because people on the left are disinclined to invoke these notions of cultural values. They sound Victorian to a lot of people on the left. You know, talk about responsibility. You talk about fathers paying attention to their families. And yet Obama sees that. I mean, he says both in Dreams and in The Audacity of Hope that his ideal family was his wife Michelle's family. Mm-hmm. Because it's a very old-fashioned Victorian family.
And he didn't have paternal involvement.
Exactly. Exactly.
I think many on the left were disappointed that he hasn't spoken out more directly on poverty. In fact, when Cornel West and Tavis Smiley did their poverty tour, they criticized President Obama for not making more of a concerted effort to target the what you were talking about, this incredible disparity in the wealth in this country. Why do you think he hasn't had something that would be equivalent to LBJ's war on poverty?
I think he has tried, and this is where I disagree with my friend Cornel West, whom I respect, but I do think that people who expect Obama to have been able to do more have not been paying attention to American politics. If you look at his inaugural speeches, both the first and the second, he lays out a plan in both of those for an increase in the minimum wage, a change in the tax code, making it much more progressive, Congress is simply not willing to go along. I don't think there's anything in Obama's speeches that would cause someone, if you read them carefully, to say he doesn't care about poverty and he doesn't care about inequality. They are front and center in all of his major addresses. The question is, what can a president do? And that's where I think Cornell is just not being realistic in suggesting that he should be able to do more. Because unless Congress is willing to address the problems of taxation that have been central to America since the late 70s and 1980s, there's not going to be enough money in the public sphere to address this problem. Unless we're willing to take seriously the need to change the minimum wage, and Obama's been talking about that for 15 years, people who are without the skills to enter the information economy are going to continue to slip further and further behind. And there's nothing a president single-handedly can do about that. That's something Congress has to address.
And he's also talked about the unequal pay for women. You write in your book that you see some evidence of feminist thought in sort of the making of Obama. Can you talk about that and which sort of women he would point to as key leaders in shaping his thought?
I think his mother, first of all. There's a very moving passage when he talks about her waking up at, was it 4:30 in the morning when they're in Indonesia to work with him on his lessons because she thought the quality of the education he was getting was not quite up to par. And she says at one point to when he's complaining, "This is no picnic for me either, Buster." And I think he admires her for what she gave him. But there's an interesting distance from her that comes out especially in Dreams because he sees her as a kind of dewy-eyed idealist. He talks about her commitment to the idea of universal values that she shared with her parents, the mid-20th century commitment to something like the United Nations Universal Declaration of Human Rights, the idea that there is something that we can all get together behind. And I think from Obama's point of view, those are, to use the words he uses, fictions. They're illusions. Cultures are particular, and cultures have particular values, and they change over time. And so I think what he admires are those people, whether they're African Americans or women, who have seen that values can change, need to change, and understand the steps that need to be taken to bring those changes forward. So I think he is a full-throated feminist without any apology and wants to make sure that his daughters have all the opportunities that any of the boys in any of their classes would have. One of the things that I find fascinating is the extent to which he understands that the changing nature of the workplace is what remains perhaps the greatest impediment for women. Because as the feminist theorist Joan Williams has written in several of her books, every person in America faces challenges that require what Williams calls family work. And most working Americans have had a spouse at home to do that. But now that women are in the workplace, they don't have a spouse at home to do that. Somebody has to do it. And so again and again, it falls to the woman, whether it's the question of aging parents or sick children or whatever the crisis happens to be. And unless our workplaces become as flexible as they need to be so that that family work can get done without one person having to opt out of the workforce, it's simply not going to be possible. And there are a few places in his books where Obama addresses that problem, but it hasn't come into focus quite as much as I think one might have predicted it would based on what he wrote before he became president.
That's the sort of thing that two-income household that plays back on what you said about education, too, because how can the parents be involved in the education of their children when they're both working 8, 9 or more hours
right,
a day?
Right, and increasingly people at the bottom of the socioeconomic pyramid are working 2 jobs each.
Right.
And so many of the low-paying jobs in America are deliberately capped at a number of hours so that benefits are not paid. And so in order for people to have enough food on the table, you have both mothers and fathers working 2 jobs, which makes it impossible for them to be engaged. So unless something is done to
break
improve
that cycle,
the income stream of those people, it's very hard to see how this problem can be addressed.
How has Obama become more compromising, do you think? I remember early on, after he was elected the first time, he said, "Elections have consequences." And the impression was that he was just going to ram this through one way or the other. Do you think he has softened his stance in that regard?
Well, I think much more was made of that statement than it deserved, because as we saw, it wasn't possible to ram things down anybody's throats because he lacked the majorities to do it. He got a health care package and a stimulus package that were the result of endless compromises. They're nothing close to what initially he had expected he would get. And I still think they were important to do. And I still think in the long run, the Affordable Care Act will be a landmark, as many people have said that it is. But in some ways, I think you could say that he has become less interested in compromise. That second inaugural is a much more feisty speech than the first one was. And I think the reason was that he realized, I'm fighting against a Republican Congress here that's simply not going to give me a break. And rather than continuing to try to conciliate them, I'm simply going to say, this is what I stand for. This is what I think our nation should try to do. Republican Congress is not going to meet him halfway on that, but I think he's stopped basically trying to do the kinds of things that he tried to do in the first term. He's going to be a Democrat. And if the Republicans don't want to accomplish anything during his second term, and so far they show no evidence of wanting to do anything at all, then that's the hand that the American people have dealt him. Elections do have consequences. And in the first term, the consequence was the Affordable Care Act and the stimulus package. In the second term, the consequence so far has been a Republican Congress that simply wants to say no.
He did chide the Supreme Court too, didn't he? In one of those addresses?
Yes. I think this is the sort of thing that presidents often do. I mean, nobody did it quite as dramatically as Franklin Roosevelt did.
So true.
But when the Supreme Court takes positions that a president feels are inconsistent with the Constitution as the president understands it, then I think it is incumbent on the president to speak out. But the way the separation of powers works, there's a limit to how much he can accomplish if he disagrees with the Supreme Court. And his appointees are people who think as he does, but the people who have been outvoting them are people who think very differently. Let me say just a word about how Obama understands the Constitution. He is, after all, trained as an attorney. He taught law at the University of Chicago Law School. And he writes in The Audacity of Hope that we should think of the law as a nation arguing with its conscience, which I think is a marvelous
phrase. Yeah.
And he sees the Constitution as emerging from a conversation in the 18th century, and he thinks that we should continue to think of the law as a conversation. Now, those people on the Supreme Court who invoke what they call an original interpretation, as far as Obama is concerned, simply don't understand the Constitution, because there was no single original meaning in the Constitution.
That's right.
It was a compromise between people who had vastly different understandings of what a self-governing people could and should do. So Obama writes, I think, brilliantly, based on the best constitutional legal scholarship we have in The Audacity of Hope, about how we should understand the Constitution as a living, breathing document that has been adjusted over centuries to meet new needs. And that's, I think, the reason why he's impatient with the Supreme Court.
Some final thoughts on reading Obama when we continue in a moment with University of the Year.
I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Emily Auerbach and our guest James Kloppenburg. He's the author of Reading Obama, Dreams, Hope, and the American Political Tradition. And we're looking at the way that Obama thinks and those factors that have shaped the way Obama thinks and therefore, of course, how he responds to various situations. What does Obama have to say about the Tea Party? And is it largely a reaction to Obama, or does it actually have that kind of strident effect before he's even elected?
The Tea Party grows out of an old tradition in American history and American culture of distrust of centralized authority. And one of the striking things in The Audacity of Hope is Obama's awareness that this wariness about the central government is as deep as anything else in American culture. Now, the problem for him is that he thinks certain issues have had to be addressed by using the central government because there have been problems such as slavery, such as the persistence of white supremacy in the post-Civil War South that simply would not have been addressed at the local level. And so there's an awareness, I think, both of the legitimacy and the vitality of that decentralist impulse and an awareness that the other side of that impulse has been a deep-seated racism. And so if you acknowledge that that is at least one component in some of the people who are drawn toward movements like the Tea Party, then it's problematic. And so I think that's what makes it difficult for him, because the question is, how do you disentangle the legitimate aspirations of people who see America as a uniquely decentralized culture in which local control is very important from the other strands that are simply white supremacist? And some of the blatant disrespect that has been paid to him both by members of Congress and by the press does seem to me to be over the top in a way that's hard to understand short of invoking the explanation of racism. But there are other issues having to do with the Tea Party that seem to me perennial in American history. And I think, again, taking Obama's analysis of American politics in The Audacity of Hope as my text rather than the speeches he gives as President of the United States, it does seem to me as though he knows where they're coming from, to use that phrase.
Well, that issue of central control versus local control, I mean, that accounts for the Confederate States of America.
Right.
And a lot, of course, of the dialogue going back to the founding of the Republic. That's one of the major themes that's been sounded in American politics from day one, is how much central control, how much local control. But for some reason, healthcare in particular seems to have set off particularly vitriolic debate over that regard.
Mm-hmm. And in much the same way that many of the steps taken in the Progressive Era did, and in many of the same ways that steps taken during the New Deal did, and the Great Society. I mean, this is a kind of alarm that is set off whenever the federal government takes on a new initiative. But we've all seen the poster, "Get the Government's Hands Off My Medicare,"
right.
That suggests just how incoherent many American attitudes about politics are. Somehow government is perceived as something that the other guy is doing to someone,
yes,
rather than something that we as a people are doing for each other. And that kind of incoherence seems to me utterly unproductive.
Now, what about the notion of deficit spending, though? I mean, the Republicans, on the face of it, seem to be saying, I don't mean just Tea Party here, I mean Republicans in general, look, we've got to balance the budget. We can't keep spending and spending and spending and raising the debt ceiling, which is what Obama seems to espouse, is, well, let's raise the ceiling and take care of what needs to be taken care of.
Well, people tend to forget that the debt ceiling was raised, I think, 11 times during the presidency of George W. Bush, and no one said a word about it. No Republican raised that as an issue. So again, this strikes me as a strictly partisan issue. It's not grounded in any genuine problem that the deficit might cause. We've been doing deficit spending in this country for almost a century, and it hasn't caused as much trouble. Economists are split on how much deficit spending is a problem, but there's no indication that the amount we have now is a problem. In fact, the deficit is shrinking, and again, Republicans are disinclined to acknowledge that the reason we no longer have the balanced budget we had under Bill Clinton is the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. And if anyone had had the courage to say, we are going to war, we have to pay for it, taxes would have been raised and the deficit would not have grown as it did. But from my perspective, saying we're going to war and no one has to pay for it is a way to cut into the sense of belonging to a common project on which I think American democracy rests. So that's a particular feature of the years since 2000 that I think needs to come into sharper focus. I think we are moving in the direction of cutting the deficit. We could move a whole lot faster in that direction if we would be willing to pay taxes for the obligations that we've already undertaken.
I wanted to ask you about a strain in American culture that seems anti-intellectual when in regard to politicians such as Atlee Stevenson or others, who, where it almost is, can go against you if you are a philosopher, if you are somebody who studies, if you have degrees, if you think deeply and deliberatively that can hurt you compared to if you look to be someone that you could just sit down and have a beer with. Can you talk about how responses to President Obama in part are reflective of that?
It's a serious issue. I think it's a serious issue in all political circumstances. It's perhaps particularly pronounced in the United States, but it's also true elsewhere. When someone seems ineffectual, seems reflective, that person tends to seem weak. François Hollande in France is a good example of that right now, whereas Angela Merkel in Germany looks very decisive and she looks very, she's a very thoughtful, intelligent woman, but she comes across as a really feisty leader.
Or Putin with his on a horse or with a bear or whatever.
Let's not go there. But I do think this is a serious problem in the United States, and it has been for presidents who have been accused of being intelligent. It's a dangerous thing to be thoughtful. But I don't think it's decisive. He was, after all, elected president twice, and I'm not sure. I mean, there are certain precincts in American culture where education is held against you. In far more parts of America, education is respected. People want to have an education. It's one of the highest aspirations parents have for their children, to get an education. So it's a kind of schizophrenia, I think, in America, that we claim to value education. It is the one social program to which we do continue to devote resources, and we spend more on education than any other culture does, although you wouldn't know it from looking at the results. And so I think it gets a lot of attention, but often the people who are making the loudest complaints about how overeducated he is are people who themselves have graduate degrees. I mean, Mitt Romney had to stop talking about Harvard when it was clear that he had two Harvard degrees and Obama only has one. So a lot of people who write in the conservative press, who are active in radio and television, who are making these arguments, are themselves very highly educated. So I think it's a very peculiar feature of American politics. But again, it's one of those features that has been present for a very long time, at least since Andrew Jackson, and it's not going away.
It would be interesting to know, and there might be two answers to this, it would be interesting to know who he would endorse as his successor, because there's nobody like Obama out there. I mean, I suppose the first name that comes to mind is Hillary Clinton, but of course he had a fairly contentious relationship with her early on. It would be interesting to know. Of course, publicly, he's going to endorse the party candidate, but it would be interesting in particular to know who he would really want to succeed him.
I think in some ways he has been a centrist Democrat his entire public career. He's not somebody who's far to the left, as many people on the left mistakenly thought he was. He's not a triangulator, somebody who wants the Democratic Party to become more like the Republican Party. And so that's a clear difference between him and, I think, at least some members of the Clinton team. I think Hillary herself is actually a more progressive Democrat than people give her credit for. If you look at her trajectory over time, she actually is a member or has been a member of the Democratic wing of the Democratic Party. But I wouldn't say that about Bill Clinton. And so the question is whether she's going to run as Hillary Clinton or she's going to run as Bill Clinton. And his approach actually worked better than hers. It's clear that moderates do better in American politics, national politics, than do people who are perceived to be extremists. So it does seem as though she's the almost the default candidate at this point. And I don't think he'll have a lot of trouble endorsing her. I think the two of them had to work pretty hard to find issues on which they disagreed in the last campaign. I think they're actually, in terms of their programs and their policies and their predilections, quite similar to each other. And I don't see that as being particularly difficult as a succession. There are personality tensions, but when the campaign was unfolding in 2008, many of us who consider ourselves to be on the left were more drawn to her than to him because she seemed like a more progressive Democrat. I mean, I was drawn to somebody to the left of Denis Kucinich, so I'm not a good judge of these sorts of things. But I think if you were lining them up on an ideological spectrum, Obama is in the middle of the Democratic Party, and I think Hillary might have been at that point two notches to the left of him. So I don't think there's very much to choose between the two of them in the kinds of programs they're likely to endorse. I don't know that she would be accused of being as firmly committed to deliberation as he is. She does seem a more decisive person and has seemed for a very long time, and that's part of what a lot of people, myself included, admire about her. So I don't know that would cause him difficulty. At this point, it's hard to see who her competition is going to be
in the
Democratic Party, so it may be a moot question who he would like to see succeed him.
Thank you very much for joining us. Our guest has been James Kloppenburg, professor of history at Harvard and the author of the book Reading Obama, Dreams, Hope, and the American Political Tradition. A pleasure having you with us.
Thank you very much. My pleasure to be here.
I'm Norman Gilliland with Emily Auerbach, and I hope you'll join us for the next hour of University of the Year.